All right. I'm here with Richard and Ahmad today, and these guys are just about to embark on a long journey from Malawi back to Western civilization. They've been over there now. When did you get there? In mid-June, early June?
Yeah, June 20th.
June 20th. June 20th. Okay. And they've been there working on water projects, and they've been kind enough to jump on this evening, their time, to talk to us a little bit about what they've been working on this summer and to get some really fresh reflections from a summer of field work in Malawi. So why don't, if you guys don't mind, give a quick, just each give a quick bio and your background and kind of paint a little bit of a picture of how this whole thing started, how you got involved with this work in the first place, and then we'll come up to the point where you landed in Malawi this summer.
So what's up? My name is Ahmad. I'm a junior. I'm at Stanford, majoring in environmental engineering. And I guess what I got involved in this project was that my sophomore year, I actually wanted to be a part of actually a similar theme, working with biochar. But unfortunately, I wasn't able to. So I was like, okay, this is the year I have to do it. So I applied for the project, and luckily, I got into it. And we've been working on this since the winter quarter, so winter and then spring, and then now we're here for the summer. And I was very excited because it's been a very long time since I've been back to Africa. I actually lived in Nigeria for a few years, so I was like, this is a perfect opportunity, man. I get to work on water, which is what I study, and then also be back basically home, so it's cool.
And then, my name is Richard, sitting next to Ahmad. I am a sophomore also at Stanford, working in the same project context as Ahmad. So our school has an Engineers for a Sustainable World chapter, and this biochar project is just a, it's a project in that, club. And so, I really wanted to have an opportunity to work on an engineering project, but not only that, one that had a lot of sustainability undertones. And I think, biochar, taking agricultural waste, turning it into charcoal and filtering water with it, I thought that was a really cool, concept. And then I also had a great environmental theme. And I also was just like, I've grown up pretty sheltered. Might as well jump into the deep end, working in the context of Malawi. And so I'm really grateful I did that because I've grown a lot from this experience, and both academically and just like personally.
So initially, you guys made contact with the folks you're working with there through the Engineers for a Sustainable World chapter project or something. I just want to kind of get a picture of like how the relationship evolved and how you got connected, and talk a little bit about your contacts there and what you did to prepare for the trip. And was there a lot of back and forth, before you came, or how did you plan it out? How did you do that?
We got connected through Engineers for Sustainable World, or ESW. That began in winter, but I guess you started earlier because you can go ahead.
So ESW has been working with various nonprofits in the context of biochar for several years now. It actually started off this project in Ghana with cacao husks and trying to, make use of the waste that was piling up with that. Water filtration actually wasn't a part of the project back then. It was just a matter of recycling. But then over time, I guess the relationship with we sort of they sort of lost contact with the cacao organization, and so they pivoted to a nonprofit in Malawi called the Wildlife and Environmental Society. And so this year, me and Ahmad and the rest of our team, we have four others, we've just been calling really frequently with that nonprofit, the Wildlife Environmental Society. We'll call them WESM for short. And just like working on prototypes at Stanford, doing a lot of research, always keeping them in the loop. And then eventually we had an opportunity from Stanford to come here on like a funded stipend fellowship. It's called the African Service Fellowship. We have a it's a public service one. And so that sort of fell into place, and they were very happy to have us because they really wanted people to actually like, turn this remote abstract work into physical impact. And so that's what we were able to make progress on this summer.
So it's the initial thing started out with a connection in Ghana, and then somehow it migrated over to Malawi. And are you guys the first group of people from Stanford to make contact in person in Malawi, or has there been kind of a series of people to go through?
I think pretty sure we're the first,
Yeah, at least for our project, yeah, we're the first, yeah.
You're the first, okay. And so tell me a little bit about what you were doing to prepare in the months leading up to this. Like, you were doing some prototyping, you're testing some stuff. What about just kind of give me an idea of like what the preparation was like.
Yeah, so we prepared through a class sequence that our ESW chapter offers. So it's two quarters. It's called Engineering and Sustainable Toolkit. The curriculum starts off by having you just perform a literature review, really get understanding of what the topic is, what the problem is. And then there's a lot of, you know, ethical case studies. So given that we're working in the context of development, it's really important to have like that, you know, good ethical moral compass going into it and be able to anticipate some of the pitfalls you might fall into working halfway across the world from the people you're trying to, you know, collaborate with. And so after that,
what were some of those? And so in terms of the ethical pitfalls and things like that, so you're trying to imagine that stuff kind of before you're getting there. You're coming up with some ideas, brainstorming and stuff. So talk about that, and then talk about, you know, when you, in your actual experience, did you see a lot of that stuff, or did it highlight some certain things more than others, or how did that come up?
Yeah, I guess at least for me, I guess one of my biggest takeaways from the course that we took was more of like coming in with a listening mindset, so listening first approach. So going there and actually like listening to what people have to say instead of trying to bring our ideas that we've been working on there first without listening. And I guess in context of like how applicable it was, I would say it was very applicable. It was very nice to be able to hear other people's opinions on our prototypes over the winter and the spring, to give comments, suggestions, and feedback. So at least for me, I thought that was very helpful.
Yeah, and I'll add on to that. Like the whole listening attitude really shaped the project during our, I guess, from the Western perspective, summer here, because we came in with the idea of, you know, what we were going to do, you know, biochar for water filtration. And then through listening to the community, we actually found a lot of new leads in the biochar production process that we just hadn't really imagined before. So a lot of opportunities opened up after we, you know, thanks to our listening attitude.
Okay, I definitely want to drill down into some of that stuff, but I don't want to get ahead of ourselves here. So you have some preparation through your coursework and through the connections and stuff through the university. You're able to apply for this fellowship, which is providing funding, support, and all that kind of stuff. So then try to remember back to what it was like when you first hit the ground. Like, what was that first 24 or 48 hours like? What kind of, you know, were you like traveling out to project sites? Were you just getting acclimatized? Or like, what was that like? And what were some of your first impressions?
At least for me, it was a very long first day. It was a crazy set of events. So what happened was that our supervisor and his friend, someone else who also works in the Department of Biological Sciences, came over to pick us up. However, they got into an accident on the way there. So they had to drop that car off at a place to get repaired. They had to get another car, they had to borrow another car essentially, and then come and get us. But the car they got to come get us with at the airport was too small. So then they took our luggage to give to like a brother, and then they then took that car to get the other car to come get us. And then we had to finally go to like get lunch, and they were there for like a long time.
It's like the inception of airport pickup.
It was crazy, man. They left there, and then we finally drove to the north where we did our project in Mizuzu. So it took us like the entire day. I think we got there like at 1 a.m., 2 a.m. The next day. But it was very cool to just be able to like to be in an environment, look around. So at least for me, it was very cool to be able to just chill. It wasn't too crazy for me, at least.
I'd say the first week we're doing a lot of acclimatizing, and I think from there on it was just sort of like figuring out, okay, where do we get the materials we need for this stuff, like what tools or what stuff down to the point of like what workspaces on campus can we use to test the biochar production or test the filters or build stuff, you know, just gradually building each of those blocks up.
Okay. So then so tell me about your home. Like, so did you have a kind of home base where you're working out of this whole time, or have you been moving around? And it sounds like you have a connection there with the university and had some space to work in. What was that like?
Yeah. So I guess for context, our time in Malawi was spent at the a university called Mizuzu University in the north. And our home base there was essentially this lab called the EES lab, Ecology and Environmental Sciences Lab. And so that was our maker space, our testing space, right out the door was our kiln burning space. That was our home base there. And the university was very gracious to lend us that, you know, essentially classroom, and as well as all their time and and effort. I'm still like very heartwarmed by all the into it.
And so were you like staying like in a dorm or something with the university, or staying with the family, or what were your arrangements?
It was a guest house.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. So, on campus. Mm-hmm. So we had a room to ourselves, and then a little kitchen, which I used for the first week and then gave up on because I can't really cook very well. And then just lived out of there. It was pretty good.
Okay.
Yeah, it was very good to be on campus too. Like you just simply walk to the lab. So everything was very close to each other.
Oh, good. Okay. So, okay. Well, give me some idea then of some of the testing, some of the project stuff you're working on. You're working on water filter designs. And the idea was you kind of go in with some ideas about how to set up different filter systems. And then that the listening phase kicks in and you're kind of getting feedback and modifying your designs. Or how did that play out?
Yeah. So I guess we began with the kiln process first. So I guess the very beginning, first it was getting all the materials. So the body, the chimney, just everything. It's actually a very, very fun process to get all these different materials because we didn't come here with much. We really came here with like very few tools. So we actually had to buy the bulk of everything here. So we had to go with people from the department just showing us around the area to find where we can buy these things. And luckily we found the things we needed. And then from there, we started constructing the kiln and then started testing the kiln. So I guess the way we tested the kiln, or I guess we can talk more about the design. I'll let you go ahead.
Yeah, well, I'd say the design was just sort of, you know, top lit updraft gasifier, you know, holes in the bottom of a bucket, holes in the top of a bucket, controlling airflow. And then we were just testing to see, you know, when you stack corn cobs into this and light them on fire from the top, how does it perform? And we got really lucky because the first time we did it, it burned smokelessly like it's supposed to. And that was something that we had not achieved for like 10 plus weeks at Stanford. And it was sort of a miracle, but, you know, we kind of went with it, just testing different, you know, or like what happens if you stack corn cobs horizontally instead of vertically? It turns out that makes the burn smokier, right? And then what happens if you expose it to wind? Turns out that's not the best idea. So just testing different variables, having fun with it. And then for the last 5 weeks of our time here, we did a lot of testing of the water filter. So like you said, testing different filtration setups. We had one bucket of biochar, so a 20-liter bucket. And then we had another separate system with gravel and sand, which, you know, we were heavily inspired by your research when it all came to this, because, you know, you're the guy who's done a lot of field work with this. And so we were just seeing if we could replicate that system with our own like set of materials and just collecting water from the local river, pouring it into the different systems, testing it with, you know, what equipment the university had. So spectrophotometers, we brought some heavy metal strips, and then some plating tests for microbes. So we learned a lot about wet lab stuff too. So that was sort of the testing process.
Okay. So you're talking about how you were setting up a biochar gasifier to run off a corn cob. So I'm curious how you settled on corn cobs, if that was your main feedstock and what informed that. And you said that you got it to work better than you had previously in some of your testing at Stanford. What do you think was the difference there that made it work in one situation and not in another?
The reason why we chose maize cobs here, because maize is a staple of food here, at least in northern parts of Malawi. Most families actually grow maize just for their family, and a lot of meals revolve around maize, so therefore there's a ton of maize cobs around. And the majority of people either just leave it in the field to rot away, maybe for manure, or they just burn it. But that can be very smoky, harmful for them and also for the environment. So just based on just that, we were like, okay, let's work with maize cobs. Mm-hmm. And it's actually a very nice ingredient to use for the kiln. And what was the other question? Why it was different from
design, back? Yeah.
I would assume because we just had more holes here. We could talk more about the difference, though.
Yeah, I'd say the biggest differences between our design, the biggest differences between our design here versus Stanford were, I guess, we had smaller holes in our kiln here. So at Stanford, we were poking like half inch or bigger holes, some mostly just out of desperation. And so here we sort of couldn't do that because our drills couldn't pierce, bigger drill bits couldn't actually pierce the metal we were using here. So we set it on these 1/4 inch holes. And that actually led to a smokeless burn. We also had a bigger chimney. So all the air escaping that gasifier could, you know, escape in a greater quantity more quickly. And so that probably increased the draft.
What was the size of your gasifier? Was it a full-on 55-gallon drum or something smaller than that?
No, it was a 16-liter metal bucket, and the chimney was a chicken feeding cone. So yeah, that gives you a general sense of the size of things.
So something that we've definitely found over the years in terms of getting the gasifier to work well for producing water filtered char is if the feedstock is really dry. Moisture content in the feed will end up eating up a lot of your energy in the process to drive off the moisture, and that creates more smoke and you get a lower yield of char and so on. So, and often, depending, I was just mentioning that I'm about to head off to Ecuador for a few weeks of field work. And when I first went last year, and my question, of course, was like, when's your dry season? When's your dry season? And they're like, well, we're in the Amazon. We don't really have a dry. It's like a little bit drier, maybe like September, but it's really could rain anytime. Whereas,
More of a less wet season.
what's that?
More of a less wet season.
Yeah, a less wet. They have a wet season and a less wet season. Whereas where I had a lot of experience previous to that was in Southeast Asia, where there is a more clearly demarcated wet and dry season. So what is
Right.
it like? What is it like there? Is it really clear wet and dry? And what season are you in now?
Yeah, there's a wet and dry season. We happen to be in the dry season, and we also happen to be right after the harvest. So that was two lucky strikes on our end.
Good. And you knew that going in, or that just it just turned out, or?
This happened to be that way, at least for me.
Same. I was pleasantly surprised.
Okay, so then you mentioned, so you got your biochar gasifier bucket system to work pretty well, and then you're working with different filter media testing different water. What kinds of water contaminants were you most concerned about? Did you have ideas going in about what were going to be the big problems? Did you learn about from locals like what they think a lot of the water contamination problems are, and how did you talk about water quality with the people you're working with there?
Yeah, correct. So actually, a supervisor gave a lot of insight into the different parameters to test for in the water here in the northern parts of Malawi. So stuff we measured and tested for were microbes, so coliform, total coliform counts of fecal, non-fecal E. coli, and also Salmonella. We also measured the turbidity of the water, total dissolved solids, or the TDS, salinity. What else? The metals using the strips that we had here. We had the pH. The carbonate, the alkalinity. What else do we have? We have nitrates, and
Conductivity too.
conductivity as well, EC of the water. I'm probably missing a few, but those are the ones that come off the top of my head right
Yeah, our supervisor was really big on nitrates. That's a field of his study. His name is Mr. Twalibu Tandwe, and he was the one who really exposed us to the importance of nitrates, which we hadn't really seen as a emphasis before coming here. We were really focused on the E. coli and the stuff that's most commonly spoken about, like that.
Okay, so nitrates, are these coming more from agriculture? Are they coming from like us latrines and sewage, or like where are the nitrates coming from?
Yeah, I would say the vast majority probably are from latrines. Actually, they are from latrines. We actually went to two different locations to test out the water. So we actually went there in the beginning of our time here to actually see the levels of contaminants in the water. So we went to places called Zolozolo West and Vongo, and when we went there, we went to each location where people got their water, not each, but at least the majority of them. And we saw that they were all near either latrines. However, there was one main one that was near livestock manure, which is a river source, and they just take their livestock to the river to drink. So there's a ton of manure there. The majority were from latrines.
How and so how what are people's water points like? Are they using wells? Are they just getting buckets out of the river? Are they collecting rainwater? What's the water source for most people?
Yeah, at least based on the two places that we visited, one location, which was Vongo, they had the river that was used by the livestock as well, and they also had boreholes. And then other locations, those of the west, they had shallow wells, so either unprotected or protected shallow wells.
Thing about Vongo though with the river was that they actually preferred to use the river as opposed to the boreholes, even though there was that fecal contamination because the boreholes had a bunch of salinity. So we were never really we weren't really seeing people collecting the boreholes. It was more so them coming up from the riverbank with a bucket on their head and just hauling it back home.
Yeah.
Okay. So they just haul it by the bucket, take it back home, and dump it into a drum or something at home and use it from that? Or is that how most people do it? Or and so
Yeah,
you're
so we
also,
actually connected a survey.
I'm sorry, the connection's a
Sorry.
little off. Talking over you, so please go ahead and finish. Sorry about that.
Oh, my bad. Yeah, so I said we collected a survey. I actually asked residents of how they collected their water and what they did with it if they stored it. So a lot of people use like 20-liter buckets, plastic pails to fetch their water, either by going to the shallow well, or going to the river or the borehole, and then they then put in like a bigger container. Some people cover it, some people don't. But yes, I think that answers your question.
And so then the idea then was then for like small, like a sort of kitchen tabletop household filtration, or what kind of treatment system were you envisioning for, or are you talking about more like a centralized system that everyone would bring their water and pass it through a filter system, or what were you thinking about in terms of design of treatment?
Yeah, good question. I would say, at least for me, I don't know, I didn't really plan that much because you actually wanted to just see if the filter would work in the first place. And if it did, then we can like look into how it could be implemented. But at least when we finished, which was a few days ago, we just couldn't get to that part. At least that's for me. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think I don't know how much I can speak about on the podcast, but we spoke with you about the whole, gravel and sand being a main filtration step for most water, and then biochar being like a polishing step. And so throughout our testing and through the, after we dealt with the logistics of washing filter sediments, constructing a filter, running water through everything, it sort of shaped out in our minds that maybe gravel and sand are like a really good central system and biochar is a good household system, right? Because with gravel and sand, you got to wash a ton of that stuff and it's got to be in a big container. And big containers take a lot of plumbing and tools. Whereas biochar, you drill a hole in a 20-liter bucket, you dump biochar into it, and that's, in our opinion, more easily scalable. So it shaped out that way as a, I guess, more of a logistical, the logistics shaped out that way.
Okay, so you think then that you could, in some instances, have a centralized larger system to get some levels of treatment, gravel, sand, like remove the turbidity, take care of the pathogens and stuff like that, and then maybe smaller household units for biochar or something. That and is that you're saying that you kind of focused on that as a possibility or an outcome of like your observations, or is that the next step of the project, or what are you thinking about that?
At least the way I was envisioning it was more of like so the gravel in the sand was more of like a beginning step, and you can use that water for things that you might not drink, so irrigation, for example. And then if you like to purify the water even further, use the biochar at your home than to have drinking water or water for your dishes, for example. So at least that's the way I envision that.
And then another idea is maybe we could have biochar as, something that's ubiquitous in households. And that's maybe even the first step if the gravel and sand is maybe too challenging or expensive or what have you to make. And then you combine the biochar with some sort of separate disinfectant step. In our testing, we found that, it was really good at the chemical removal, and maybe the microbes needed a bit of help. It needed a bit of help to remove them. So a lot of options here, and I hope this project does, see some future testing because we were surprised with some of the results, the positive results that we got from biochar. And then it seems that there's potential for like a pretty economic treatment system. But it's going to take a lot of further testing.
Cool. That's exciting. When so one option you talked about was biochar in combination with disinfection. I'm curious about, do people there use chlorine to disinfect their water? Is that a common household practice or community practice?
So actually also in our survey we asked that question too. Less than 50% of out of 29 respondents either chlorine or actually chlorinate their system, less than 50%, about 47%. And then on the same 47% also boil the water as well.
They disinfect it with chlorine and they boil it. Okay, so they do have access to chlorine, so that's happening somewhat, not at 100% rate, but it's happening somewhat. How do people feel about the taste and odor? Is that an issue? Because in a lot of places where people are not accustomed to it, they hate the taste and odor of chlorine.
Yeah, they're not a fan in Malawi either.
Okay. So that's, and you probably thought through this and everything, but one of the advantages of the biochar is it can strip out chlorine, so it's good for taste and odor control. So the idea of disinfecting to kill the pathogens and then take that water, treating it with biochar to remove the taste and odor of chlorine seems like it could be a possible setup. And is that something that you, or that's what you're saying is possibly the next step would be to try to test something like that for user uptake or something?
Yeah, for sure. So I'd say the idea of using biochar in combination with chlorine seems promising to me. I think from our testing, what we noticed was that after running river water through an initial batch of biochar, we saw some slight increases in microbe content. So the reason we're pairing it with disinfectant is to, you know, get rid of that residual microbial content. But then maybe if you have maybe a second biochar bucket that hasn't been exposed to microbes, or maybe has been washed with bleach beforehand, mm-hmm. and you ensure that water going into it doesn't have any microbes in it, mm-hmm. then maybe you can strip out that chlorine. So you can have a biochar chlorine biochar sandwich system, I guess we'll call it that, where the first biochar gets rid of all the nasty stuff, albeit increasing microbes. The chlorine gets rid of the microbes, and then the final biochar sort of washes the chlorine taste out. I don't know if that would be feasible, but that seems like a promising thing to explore.
Yeah. A few years ago, we published a paper on this topic with this idea. A lot of places where they would do chlorine in a bucket system. They have like a 20-liter bucket and collect their river water in that, put in a packet of like the chlorine powder or something and swirl it. And then, yeah, this issue of the taste and odor. The other thing that we were interested in for that particular research project was, of course, when you mix chlorine with water that contains background organic matter, it can react with the background organic matter and form disinfection byproducts. Some of those have health concerns, like trihalomethanes, haloacetic acids, and some of that stuff. You probably are talking about that in some of your classes. And EPA, US EPA has all kinds of regulations about disinfection byproduct formation and that sort of thing. So we wanted to do a study to see how well biochar would be effective for removing some of those disinfection byproducts. And then I had a colleague who was doing the testing on the chlorine removal. And, you know, normally all of these water treatment challenges are so hard and all this kind of stuff, but it turns out that chlorine is one of these things that's pretty easy. Like the chlorine reacts really rapidly with the surface of the char. And it had, you know, the char itself has a huge capacity for neutralizing the chlorine. So the sort of taste and odor benefits were kind of a bonus, and we would see a little bit of removal of some of the disinfection byproducts too. So if you're interested in that line of thinking further, I'm happy to send you the paper that we have on that topic. But that sounds it's cool that we kind of came to the same conclusion there on that. So let's what surprised you the most based on your experience? Was there something or maybe give me a couple stories or anecdotes that was like completely unexpected that maybe changed the way that you look at things or just surprising or funny or frustrating or something like that? Like, what do you think really stood out in the past few weeks of your experiences doing this stuff?
Okay, I have one, at least for the project, talking about the project. The one that surprised me the most was the biochar release removal of nitrates. Because we did a lot, at least I did a lot of research looking into how to remove nitrates because supervisor really wanted to look into ways of removing nitrates from the water. And based on the research, it's like, you know, carbon biochar cannot remove it. So I'm assuming that we just need to do more tests to see if our findings that we did, because we did like a maximum 6 tests with the biochar. So to just see if this actually does increase over time, or maybe it just might be a thing, a feature of biochar, maybe at the beginning or might be in the long term. So at least that surprised me a lot, the biochar removal of nitrates.
You saw, okay. And so you did some preliminary tests about unexpected nitrate removal with the char. And was the char fresh, or was this, you were mentioning that some of the water you had filtered and over time you started to, I guess, get like a biofilm or something developing in the char. So you were like seeing variable microbial removal. So was this a char that had been had been used for a while and had possibly had established a biofilm that was contributing to some of that nitrate removal? Or can you speculate maybe on some of the mechanisms that were happening there?
So it was the same biochar that we used, so continuously running sample water through that. And we also have the biochar saturated over time. So it is feasible that a biofilm did develop on the biochar.
What about,
And
so
I
that's
guess,
kind of a, that was kind of a technical one. Was there some other, like, I don't know, just other observation you made, or was there something, you know, about the social climate or about the local environment or the topography or something else that you found really remarkable?
well, I think one thing I found, it was not so much about the filtration aspect of the project, but the production aspect. I think what surprised me was, we were demonstrating the kiln as it was working to a lot of, local students and passerbys. And they were like, one question we kept receiving was, can you cook on this thing? And it wasn't, that was something that we hadn't really focused on before getting to Malawi. But after receiving so much feedback, we were like, maybe we should see if we can cook on this thing. And so I ended up taking a lot of interest in like this maximizing, I guess, like the utility of the biochar production process. And like we eventually got to this prototype where we made a chimney out of a bunch of milk tins, and there was a little like they op the tins were cut in a way that like had a flower shape at the top that could hold a pot. And then while you're producing biochar, you could cook with it. And then I just found it so it was like a really it sort of emerged. On like it, this sort of emerged spontaneously as like a really appropriate technology because you're not only using agricultural wastes for a useful purpose, but then you're turning them into biochar. People here use charcoal for cooking, and maybe like we were able to use bio, and then we were able to use biochar as a substitute for like wood charcoal. And so this entire new branch of like combating like deforestation to make wood charcoal and use wood as a fuel and like smokeless cooking was just something that fascinated me so much. And it gave me a lot of hope about biochar production. And it kind of I came into this summer really worried about whether people would accept this technology because it does take some effort to make. But seeing the promise of the production process, if it were put to like if it had an additional useful purpose, was really surprising to me.
Did you have another anecdote you want to share among?
Yeah, I was gonna say I have something different. I guess something for me that was very cool to see was people's surprise at burning without smoke. Because like Richard was mentioning, a lot of passerby walked by when we were doing our kiln testing, and then they were like curious, like, "What's happening? What's happening?" And I'd be like, "Yeah, we're like burning." But and I'd be like, look, there's no smoke. And they're like, what? Like, what did you do to the maize cobs? What chemicals did you add? Like, what? Like, it was very shocking, at least for some people. And like, that was very cool to be able to like show them this, what we're working on, and explain it to them. Because a lot of people were very excited. They're like, wow, this is so nice. Like, because people like were complaining, like, yeah, we burned the maize cobs and there's smoke everywhere. And this, with no smoke, they're like, what? So that was cool.
So that, I mean, that's super interesting to hear that. And that like that's the kind of thing that maybe would be sort of a hook where people are initially interested because they're like, hey, this is a lot more pleasant to use than the normal kind of, you know, cooking setup that we have because of the smoke. And it was the same way in Thailand when I was first working with this method. And that design for a gasifier is was originally adapted from a cook stove. So so you kind of brought it full circle because originally the idea was like smokeless or low emission cooking for the household. And then we figured out that those devices can make a char residual. When that char, we tested that char residual for removal of herbicides and pharmaceuticals and other trace chemical contaminants. We found that it was much better than the typical, you know, garden variety kiln charcoal sold in the villages. And so we kind of switched over to this gasifier method and then just try to scale it up and make it more practical for making water treatment stuff. So now you kind of brought it back full circle. But definitely in Thailand, that was the thing that people that got the most excited about was that you could make a whole drum full of char for what, whether it's for water treatment or cooking or whatever purpose, but you could do it without smoke the whole time and stuff like that. And that turned out to be a huge selling point, almost more than you could build a water filter. They were just excited about the smokeless charcoal maker or whatever. So, okay, so let's see.
Wait,
Go
actually,
ahead.
something. I think, yeah, I think that also a very cool selling point too that people also asked was that because after the kiln burn and we made the biochar, they always asked like, so can you like use this charcoal for cooking? And I was like, yeah, you can. Like, we actually tested this. We have charcoal burners out here, and we actually put it on there, and we actually were able to like, light it up, and you could use it to make food like you would normally do with wood charcoal. So that's another good thing, but yeah.
Our housekeeper used some of it to cook the Malawian staple dish nsema, which is a corn porridge, as well as some beans. And that was just a really heartwarming. He was like, oh, can I take a batch of this home? I want to use it. And I was like, yeah, sure. Why not? And then he sent us some photos of his hands over the fire. And I was like, it was very wholesome.
That's awesome. That's super cool. Okay. So before we talk about next steps, I haven't got to go to Africa yet. I'd love to go. I think it would be sweet to go to Malawi and to see it myself. I'm just trying to imagine it a little bit, live vicarious through you guys a little bit. Are there any other sort of like aha moments or surprising things or frustrating things or disappointing things, you know, after, because I mean you've been immersed in this situation now for about 2 months, so what yeah. Like tell me some of like what are some of your key take homes, like how has this experience changed you?
I'd say it's the, you know, I mean, whenever anybody talks about a place, they always say the people are the most impactful thing. And that's certainly true here. I'd say more specifically, being in Malawi for these 10 weeks has been very, very inspirational in many ways, because people make do with very little and they make a lot with very little. And that's been an inspiring thing to witness. There's still, despite, you know, the lack of resources here, that's undeniable, you know, there's still a lot of, you know, effort being put into maximizing daily life and being open to learning new things that will make life easier. And then aside from that, there's also just this immense generosity, which almost seems paradoxical to me. You know, I'm coming out of this realizing that maybe coming from a Western region, I've paradoxically been acting a lot more selfishly than people here who have less than I do. And so I'm coming away from Malawi feeling, you know, an obligation and just feeling naturally compelled to just be a lot more generous when I come back to the US. And that's sort of just more, maybe more important than any professional development. It's just that personal development I've come away with. I'm really looking forward to it.
All right. Ahmad?
Yeah. For me, I'll say three things probably stick in my mind. Number one, I say people are pretty proud of like just being peaceful. Like, it seems random, but like, I feel like I'd be somewhere watching news about something and I'd be like, yeah, over here in Malawi, we're very, very peaceful, very nice people. We're like the warm heart of Africa. Like, they're very proud of that aspect. And I thought it was very cool. Something else I liked as well was just the nature. It's very, very pretty. Subtropical climate over here. So, like, just trees everywhere. It's just so nice. Go on a hike, just be immersed in nature. And then you also asked about maybe some drawbacks. I think for me, the biggest thing probably is just burning things often. So it's always like a smell of smoke, or at least frequently a smell of smoke. So that can be pretty jarring.
Got it. And based on your experiences then, if you, when I first moved back to the States, I've been living mostly in Southeast Asia for about 3 years, working on water filters and all kinds of stuff. And when I came back to the States, in a way, I kind of felt like a reverse missionary. Like I came back and I ended up in Boulder, Colorado, which is a very different environment than Burma. And I was like, I want to communicate like all the stuff that I learned there. And, you know, we should be learning from them. They have so much to teach us, you know. Do you have, if you could like broadcast a message to the U.S., I mean, obviously we have like all kinds of struggles and all kinds of craziness. But based on the experiences you have there, what can we learn from their situation? And what kind of message would you think like would benefit us to learn, you know, that you've experienced this past 2 months?
For me, my message would definitely be that there is an immense amount of joy in giving, and that I think a lot of the time society can, especially Western society with all the marketing and stuff, can make you feel as if you don't have enough. And so that can make you feel as if you can't give, and it's more beneficial to you to keep what you have as opposed to maybe, you know, take some of what you have and give it without anything in return. And I think what I've realized here is that people are so willing to, you know, take you out on their dime or get you a gift or just like, you know, sacrifice a lot of their time to help you with a goal of yours. We had two lab assistants who would show up every single day, even though, you know, it was the holiday of school. They were students, but they were showing up to help us with our project. And I was just like, wow, I don't know why people aren't like this more often. It makes everybody happier. And you don't notice that loss of a few dollars for the gain of a great friendship, or, you know, a wonderful few hours out at a restaurant or anything in between. So that's my message, you know, find the joy in giving.
Nice.
Yeah. And then for me, I would say, probably say hi to people and be willing to talk to new people. I think one thing that was pretty cool was that, I mean, I'm a pretty, you know, extroverted person. I can talk to people, but just like, let's say I'm chilling somewhere, I'm not talking to somebody particularly now. And then the people just come and be like, hey, like, can I buy you a drink? Hey, what are you doing? Hey, like blah, 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 just trying to talk to you. So I think that's a very cool thing because it's a nice way to make everybody feel included. And it's always cool to meet new people, hear different stories. So I'll say, yeah, say hi to people.
Cool. I'll give an introvert's plus one to that take.
Yeah, I'm an introvert too. That's definitely a challenging thing to do, but that's definitely good advice there to be more open about that. All right, so tell me about, so you guys are getting ready to do the big journey back to the West, and then it sounds like you have about another 3 or 4 weeks or so until school starts up again. So you have a period coming up where you can kind of recalibrate and gear back up for the next term. What are the next steps in terms of the work that you were doing this summer? What are the next steps of that? Is this a project that's going to continue? Are you guys going to continue to be involved in this? Is this something that gets passed to another group of students for next year? Or like, what does the future of all this look like?
Yeah. So I would assume that this would continue. I would hope this would continue. We're like a very extensive progress report that can detail what we did here and hopefully guide the next team on the next steps to take. So yes, ideally this project will continue. At least for me, I continue working on the project. Just my senior year is pretty crazy. However, I do wish the best of luck to the next team.
Yeah, I'm sure I'm in a similar boat. I think I've done all that I can to make sure that the next team of six or five or seven or however many people who works on this has a lot of good info to take off with. Okay. And for me personally, I think this project has given me a lot of confidence to work on more, you know, technically complex projects like this one. Having spent a summer drilling holes in the bucket and work understanding the science behind that to the point where I can explain it to others, maybe next year I'm looking forward to working in maybe a more like industrial manufacturing setting. Maybe like building EVs or something, or working on, you know, something that is still in line with sustainability, but is like the next level up in terms of like the technical systems at play and like the technical work. So it's been a confidence booster, and I've learned a lot. So I'm grateful for this project, for everything it's done, and to you for mentoring us, because we couldn't have done it without you.
No problem. No problem. Okay. So, So you guys you're going back, you're both going into senior year, or Richard, are you 1 year back from that, or you're both going to be seniors?
I'm 1 year back. I'll be a junior.
You'll be a junior. Okay. One of my questions was, do you think that when you graduate, are you going to move back to Malawi and kind of continue this kind of stuff? Or you're just like, look, you're at this point, you're just gathering all kinds of different experiences and figuring out, or like, tell me a little bit about what you got. I mean, you were telling me a little bit there about maybe, you know, your next type of internship or something like that. But like, what are you aiming at? And do you think that you want to get involved in like global development kind of stuff? Or how has this influenced your, you know, what you think your career is going to look like going forward?
You know, I'll say what I told someone else a few days ago, which is that I think right now I'm a little too young for Malawi. I want to get experience working in maybe, you know, different fields, yes, but also different levels of organization, right? I've still yet to have like a conventional, you know, big established company role or like internship or whatever. And I want to experience that and see what's going on. I think working in development definitely does take a lot of dedication, and it's not something that you can just, you know, jump around with and walk away from. This project has taught me that it's not a 10-week deal to get something from design to implementation. You got to stick with it for years on end, and both because the implementation takes time and also because you got to learn a heck of a lot of stuff. So I think Malawi in my future, it's a question mark, but I'm going to do a lot of exploring. And maybe when I'm older, I'll have an answer to that.
Yeah, and then for me at least, so I'm currently studying environmental engineering, and I have a focus in water systems. And actually, I guess I always had an idea of just pursuing water, any shape, way, or form, whether that's in developing countries, more developed ones. So I'm taking a course actually this year about treating water in developing countries. So very similar to what we did here, at least in some aspects. So hopefully with that, I get more of an idea of how that will look like in the future. But again, the future is always unknown, so we'll see what happens. So yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, let me see. Are there any, what's something, maybe did I miss something, or there's something that you want to share, something you want to tie things together with, or a question that you wish I would have asked, or are you just, what's it feel like to be contemplating these many, many hours in airports and airplanes and all that kind of stuff?
Well, I don't know how many, I don't know what the audience demographic of this podcast will be, but if anybody is in college or is young like us and is wondering what to do, I'd say a project like this is gonna help you grow a lot more than basically anything else. Like I said earlier, I grew up, I consider myself having grown up in a pretty sheltered environment. You know, I didn't have to, you know, think about a lot of difficult things or complex subjects. And then coming here this summer, I've had to think about everything from, you know, how am I going to get water for drinking because I can't handle the tap water, to how am I going to explain this concept of a gasifier to people who have never heard of it before, right? And so I like, if anybody in college has an opportunity to maybe get out of their hometown or like their home industry of interest and just go into a project that is really left field, especially one that is, you know, in an environment that is resource scarce and you have to be creative with it, I would say do it because you're going to learn a lot personally, professionally, and yeah, I'll have the words to describe how I've grown once I'm back in the States, but for now I just know that there's been an incredible
Would you,
change.
okay. If somebody came along, they're just graduating high school, they're trying to figure out what the next steps are. They're thinking about college or something like that. Would you say, you know, in terms of the value, the learning and stuff, doing something like this, would you say maybe do that rather than going to college? Or like, what's your feeling now on the value of this kind of learning experience versus the sort of academic school experience? Do you have a read on that?
Good question. I think in today's world, you can actually combine both if you wanted to. So for example, at least at our school, you can take a leave of absence, maybe after you get admitted, and then do that, you know, entire year of doing this kind of project. I actually want to plus one what Richard said, because I think this project is pretty cool. And that's because, like, when we talk to people, they'll be like, you know, what year are you guys in university? Are you guys grad students? And I'm like, no, we're undergraduates. They're like, whoa, like that's insane. Like, you're doing this much work, coming in every day, working out these hours to do this project. Like, they were very, very impressed. So it just shows you how like big of a scope this is, how empowering this is, how impactful this work could be. So I do think it's possible to combine both, and I do think you should at least try to do this kind of work if you have the chance and if you're interested in doing so.
Yeah, and I think another reason to do that is because, you know, it's not easy to go from the United States to Malawi. Both, you know, you got to have that connection, you got to have that the money to do it. We met someone here from the US who is in Malawi on their own dime, and that is something that I am very impressed by, because that is an expensive plane right here and back, plus lodging, plus all the resources. So if you're looking at this as an alternative to college, I mean, have that in mind. I'd say, in my opinion, it's a good start to a college experience and a good compass for your future.
Yeah. Yeah. So you met somebody who's just there on their own. Obviously, I can imagine a plane ticket being quite expensive. But like, when you're in countries, can you live? You can live pretty cheap there, or is it more expensive to live and travel
For me, yeah, very, very cheap. I'm a vegetarian.
there?
So at the restaurant that we have here on campus, back in the good days, a meal costs $1 or 1,000 kwacha. But they increased the prices recently. So now it's 1.5 or $1.50. So yeah, very cheap for a meal, but I do eat multiple meals just to keep that in mind. For lodging, for us, it costs 15 a day, but it should have been 8 a day. Yeah, I'll say just say that. Overall, I would say it is pretty affordable. Gas is expensive, however. Yeah, it can be expensive to move around the country. But I say for daily lives, at least in Mzuzu, it's affordable.
When we say it should have been 8 a day, we mean that it was $8 a day right before we arrived, and it's going to be $8 a day right after we leave. So that's unfortunate, but it's all right.
Is that because of
That's
inflation,
perfect.
or is that just, or is that was just, they were like, oh, Stanford students, they're going to give them the Stanford tax?
We don't want to comment on the motivations, but it increased to 15 when we came, and it's going to go back down when we leave. But I'd say, yeah, it's very affordable. Meals from a carnivore's perspective are $3 to $4 per meal, maybe 4 to 5 if you're in town. And then getting around is like a matter of paying someone 80 cents worth to get you from your house to the downtown area. Taxis, even like we rode a bus across half the entire country, and it cost us $19. So not bad,
Okay.
especially from a Western perspective.
So yeah, so that's yeah, so that I mean that's kind of how I started to think about it too, because so the okay, so your contact that's just there paying their own way, that's an expensive plane ticket, you got some living expenses and stuff like that, but tuition's not cheap, right? So that's kind of when I
Right.
was in the same boat, you know, whatever how that was 17 years ago, however long that was ago in Asia. I looked at it like this, you know, this is like the best value I've ever gotten in tuition, you know, in terms of like the learning per dollar, you know, that on the ground hands-on experience to me seemed like a huge value. And so I've been in this like mental tug of war for forever about, you know, trying to assess the true value of higher education and where it fits in. And you know, when I went through college back in the 90s, it was a lot easier and a lot cheaper. So you guys have it so much harder than I had it back in the day. So it's super impressive what you've been able to do to pull all this together. So let me see. Do you have any other final thoughts or anything you want to share or any messages?
Just
The light works.
we
You
should
should have
have put
done
our
this.
brightness
Yeah,
on
look
for
at
the
that. Now
entire
look good.
time.
Well, they are.
Oh, you can go through. What the heck? Yeah, aside from that should have happened an hour ago. I don't know, I have one more thought about the whole college thing, which is that you can't, for me personally, knowing me, I think I can't deny the value that a sense of structure has. I think it was important to have structure before I got to Malawi, and it's important to have structure when I come home. I
Okay.
think it's an incredible learning experience. It's also really emotionally intense. And I know that 2 months was definitely my limit, and I'm looking forward to a more structured semester. But I think everybody will know their limits the best. I don't know, just some ideas for making that decision.
Yeah, and I can also add on to this too. So I actually recently surveyed a few of my classmates for class, and I asked them actually if they feel like an adult back on campus, on our campus. And a lot of people actually said yes and no. And the reason why people said no was because of how at least our university is structured, where you can go to dining halls pretty easily, get meals, the bathrooms are clean for you, the environment mostly is clean for you. So things are very relaxed. It's very easy to get by, at least in our university. However, I would say at least when I was here, without all of those in place, like you actually feel like more of an adult. You have to take care of yourself. You gotta make your own food if you want to do that, or go to the restaurant, or just things are more adult-like here, which could be very impactful and very empowering and very allow you to grow much quicker and learn many more things in a very cool manner, I guess.
Yeah, it's proof.
Yeah.
You
So you're saying
wouldn't get by if you weren't growing.
So I, let, just to be clear what you're saying, so it's just, so is it that the environment that you're in now with this experience, it's been less structured than what you're used to, and then there's just more sort of incidental daily responsibilities in terms of that kind of stuff compared to college campus life. Is that what you're saying? Is demarcating the difference in that experience, or I'm super curious about this. So you did a survey with other classmates about whether people feel like an adult. Is that the question that you said? And then they're kind of commenting on and like their understanding what it means to be an adult and how they feel on campus.
Yeah. So it's overall a bigger survey that I asked people about their social life on campus, about their social life, security, and autonomy on our campus. I didn't ask that many people, like 10 at max. And I wrote like a paper about it and stuff. But essentially, I was just asking people how they felt they were like on campus and how our campus structure impacts their perception of how they felt like an adult. And what I was trying to say here is that because we don't have like the dining hall, for example, we don't have people cleaning our bathrooms, for example, people cleaning the dorms, for example, people cleaning the outside, for example, just because without those things available, they're doing these things yourself, makes you feel more like an adult. That's what I was trying to say.
Cool. Yeah. Awesome. Well, this has been super interesting, guys. I want to wrap. I'll see if I can think of something to wrap on, but definitely want to say safe and happy travels coming up. Ahmad, you said you're going to be in the Netherlands for a while before going back to Stanford, or what?
Yeah, so I'm just going to be in Amsterdam, EMS, for just a little bit for a weekend, and then I'm going to the UK for 3 weeks, and then I go back to school.
Okay, so you got like a little bit of visiting friends or family or pleasure time or just hanging out or...
Taking some classes. Actually, the class that I asked the survey for, I'm finishing up more on that for summer and weekend.
Very cool. Very cool. All right. Well, I took
dropping a contact. If anybody listens to this and wants to reach out to us, I don't know.
Yeah. I'll put all that stuff in the description. They can get in touch with me, and we can be in touch if anybody wants to follow up on some of those questions. I super appreciate you guys taking time on your last night in country there, and I certainly wish you happy travels and everything, and I'll probably bug you again maybe in a month or so, because I'm just curious to see. It's like, okay, we had a chance to talk now, and then you've kind of been back in quote-unquote normal life, you know, for a month or so, and maybe how your feelings have changed or something like that. It'd be interesting to see how that transition goes, and if it feels... I know I always, whenever I come back, it's always like sort of reverse culture shock weirdness, so we'll see how that... Maybe you've experienced it before, and so you're ready for it, but...
I'm betting that's going to happen for me, especially with the whole learning about generosity and giving thing. I'm going to be pretty shocked coming back.
You're going to be out on the street just giving away everything and giving hugs and stuff like that.
Exactly. Yeah, everybody.
Whatever.
Bring back the hippie.
Awesome, guys. Well, thank you so much, and happy travels, and we'll be in touch.
Yeah, thank you for having us, man.
Thank you, Josh.
All right, peace.